ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
I'm David Marr, host of Late Night Live on Radio National, where nothing's off limits.
You know, part of being an adult is dealing with discomfort.
We gather the sharpest minds around to hash over what's shaping this crazy world.
Both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party succumbed to big money.
Late Night Live, four new shows a week on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
What does an election look like when there are no financial ground rules? Hi, Damien Carrick with you. This is the Law Report on ABC Radio National. Right now, there are no political donation laws in Victoria. The previous laws, in place for nearly a decade, were overturned by the High Court last month. And with the state election only 6 months away, Premier Jacinta Allan says she's negotiating with the other parties to urgently pass new legislation through Parliament. I'm joined by Dr. Catherine Williams, the Executive Director of the Centre for Public Integrity. Over the weekend, there was a by-election in the Victorian seat of Nepean on the Mornington Peninsula. Catherine, for listeners around the country, tell us about the seat of Nepean. Where is it and what are the demographics?
So, Damien, for your listeners in Victoria, they'll probably know this area well. It's a famed part of Victoria because of its natural beauty. It's a part of Victoria that encompasses some really affluent areas like Sorrento and Portsea, but it also extends to encompass areas that do have some challenges around disadvantage and homelessness, Dramana, Macrae, Rosebud as well. So it's a mixed electorate. Interestingly, it's also the electorate that is Victoria's oldest with a median age of 53. And it's an electorate that is considered a safe Liberal seat. In fact, the Liberal Party has held that seat for all but one term in the last 40 years.
And indeed, they did win last weekend's by-election. They held the seat. Now, the election followed the recent High Court decision that struck down Victoria's political donation laws. Very briefly, what was that system that was struck down and what was now possible in this latest by-election that was not possible previously?
So what happened with that High Court Hopper decision was that the entire Part 12 of the Victorian Electoral Act was invalidated. And really the key features of that part included transparency requirements so that we were able to see really in the end within about 28 days who had donated how much and to whom. There it was a ban on foreign donors. There was a ban on anonymous donations. There was a requirement for state campaign accounts, which is really important for audit purposes. And there was public funding in place. There was also a donations cap. So we have no longer got any of those features in place. Really a complete vacuum of political finance regulation in Victoria.
So what did that look like in this election?
Well, it's a really good question because unless you were in the electorate, you probably don't have much of a sense of what it looked like. Did it translate to more core flutes around because people could spend more printed T-shirts, more advertising materials? We really just don't know because we have no visibility of any of it.
Up until the High Court decision, the Victorian Electoral Commission had a real-time donation register. That went dark.
That's right. The entire transparency register on the VEC website has been removed in the wake of the Hopper decision. So we can not only not see what may have been flowing in ahead of the Hopper decision in preparation for the Nepean by-election, but we can't see any historic information either.
What about public funding? That was part of the previous system.
And that's right. So one of the real challenges now is that we don't have in place a system to reimburse candidates using that dollar per vote reimbursement system that is the system used really everywhere around the country in public funding of elections. There's nothing in place, which is obviously very challenging for candidates who may have, as we know at least one of them did, expended significant amounts of their own money.
So fine if you're a member of a big party, not so good if you're an independent.
That's exactly right.
So it's a bit of a black hole. What might have been happening?
Well, what I think we can assume in a sense, Damien, is that we know that there are some wealthy interests in this country who want to be able to have an influence on the political process. And we know, say, for example, at the federal level, where there are no donations caps in place at the moment, that some of those interests have been contributing very, very significant amounts to their favoured political parties and candidates. Now, if those interests were intending to influence the Victorian political process in the same way, and they were not legally prevented from doing so, I suppose it's rational to imagine that they may have been making significantly sized donations here in Victoria, and that that money could have been being spent as the candidates and parties wish to.
It's rational and it's legal, right?
That's right.
So let's shift focus to the federal level. There is a by-election in the New South Wales seat of Farah this coming weekend. That election is as a result of the resignation of ousted Liberal leader Susan Ley. What are the demographics of that seat, and what are the political donation laws that apply to this federal poll?
A demographic, in a sense, is different because it is more of a rural seat than what a Nepean is. Obviously, given it's a federal seat, far more voters in that electorate. But similarly to Nepean, it's considered a safe Conservative seat. Some other really interesting parallels too, that they are both by-elections needing to be fought as a result of the resignation of a sitting Liberal member, and in both cases, Labor isn't contesting and didn't contest in Nepean on the weekend the election. And then in relation to your question on what political donations laws are in place, well, precisely the same laws that were in place at the last federal election. So we have seen the legislating of significant amendments to that scheme. That was set to commence operation at the 1st of July this year, but it's needed to be delayed to commence from the 1st of January 2027. That means that what's in place at the moment, transparency requirements, but they're very, very high threshold transparency requirements, very different from what was in place in Victoria. We don't have donations caps, we don't have expenditure caps in place, but we do have public funding, of course, in place federally.
Last week, there was a lot of attention on the announcement by One Nation leader Pauline Hanson. She announced that billionaire Gina Rinehart had given her, quote, a sexy new private plane worth more than $1.5 million to use it in the lead up to the next federal election. And she also said that close associates of Gina Rinehart had donated another $2 million to the One Nation Party. So that's, again, absolutely legal and rational under the current system.
That's absolutely right. So as long as those donations are being disclosed, as they are required to be, to the AEC, they'll then be published on their transparency register. There's nothing at all illegal about those donations.
Can we compare and contrast this with the recent South Australia election in March? Very briefly, what are the rules in South Australia?
So in South Australia, following very significant amendments made to their political finance regime at the end of 2024, there's now a system in place that says that incumbent members are not, and major party members are not, able to accept donations. Now, there is the possibility for new entrant independents, minor party representatives, to raise small amounts of donations in order to enable them to compete in elections. But certainly for incumbent major party candidates, they are no longer able to raise donations. So it's a very, very significant shift in that state.
And South Australian One Nation politician Corey Bernardi, he announced that he would pay back billionaire Gina Rinehart $40,000 in flights taken during the recent South Australia election. That's because those flights breached the South Australian electoral laws, right?
That's right. That's right. But as Corey Bernardi subsequently said in a statement, he said that it was worth every cent to ensure that the remote and regional communities could have their voices heard.
Hmm.
And so this presents an interesting, I think, issue to think about, and that is, what is the sanctions regime in place for accepting a donation that may be in breach of their legislation? Because if the penalty is not so significant as to really disincentivise breach, surely it will be the case that people really determined to win and able to access donations would be tempted to say, well, look, actually, what's worth more to me right now is going down this path instead of going down a path of compliance. So I think the scheme itself, and indeed schemes regulating political donations around the country, really need to have appropriate sanctions in place, and regulators really need to have a graduated enforcement mandate so that we can really look at incentivising compliance with those important laws.
This is the Law Report on ABC Radio National, today looking at campaign finance laws. So we have a range of different schemes around Australia. The laws at the federal level are about to change. The political laws in South Australia are relatively tight. And right now there are no laws at all in Victoria. It's a total free-for-all. So why did the High Court of Australia strike down Victoria's political donation laws? Well, in a unanimous decision, the court found that they were unconstitutional because they impermissibly burdened the implied freedom of political communication. Lawyer Kira Peacock acted for the two political candidates who successfully challenged this law. Kira, tell me about your clients. Who are they?
My clients were two independent candidates from the 2022 Victorian state election. Melissa Lowe ran as an independent in the seat of Hawthorne, and Paul Hopper ran as an independent in the seat of Werribee. He subsequently contested the 2025 by-election in Werribee, and over the course of the last 18 months has been setting up his own party to run in the western suburbs of Melbourne called the West Party.
What was the law that they successfully challenged in the High Court?
So in 2018, the Victorian government brought in a new campaign financing system for Victorian elections, and they introduced some fairly sweeping changes to Victorian electoral laws, which included real-time disclosure of donations. There were prohibition on certain foreign donors making donations to Victorian electoral candidates and parties. And quite significantly for this case, they introduced caps on donations. So it was a fairly sweeping reform that has been in place for about 8 years and first came into effect at the 2022 state election.
And the government said it was designed to address corruption and undue influence in politics by, you know, shifting state campaigns away from large private donors towards, you know, publicly funded elections. But in doing so, your clients argued that they were privileging the established parties at the expense of the independents. And that was because part of this legislation talked about something called nominated entities. What are they?
Nominated entities were effectively created in these 2018 reforms. It was a term that we hadn't really seen much in Australian electoral systems before. And it referred to the, I guess, ability of a party to nominate a particular entity. And that entity could give the party unlimited amounts of money. To become a nominated entity, they had a certain set of criteria which spanned from, in effect, an organisation that was controlled by the party through to an organisation that just operated for the benefit of a party.
So there were these nominated entities, but only for the three established parties, the Labor Party, the Liberal Party and the Nationals. And these organisations effectively hold the assets and then distribute the resources to political parties. So they got around this kind of $5,000 donation cap, didn't they?
That's right. The $5,000 donation cap didn't apply to any transfers they made to the party, and in particular to the party's campaign account, which is the account that the party has to use to spend on its like electoral campaigning rather than its admin. So the effect of that was that the Cormac Foundation, for example, which is worth about $80, $90 million in net assets, could transfer unlimited amounts straight into the campaigning ability of the Victorian Liberal Party.
So what practical impact did this exception around nominated entities have on your two clients? They were relying on donations capped at $5,000 from each individual or organisation, whereas the other parties had access to all these unlimited funds from nominated entities. What did that mean for your clients?
Well, certainly in the 2022 election, when both of my clients were contesting for the first time, they didn't have access to any public funding, whereas a lot of their competitors would get advanced public funding, which was part of those 2018 reforms. They were really reliant on getting incremental amounts of money from any willing donors unless they could self-fund to an extent. So they were up against quite a a daunting prospect of facing an opponent who really had limitless funds. The funds were only constrained by the value of the nominated entity and how much that nominated entity was willing to gift. So it was really daunting. Certainly the donation caps have made it very difficult for my client Paul Hopper to start up the West Party, difficult to advertise, to even get people to enrol. So yeah, certainly the system, they felt, really inhibited their ability to properly communicate with the electorate and let the electorate know what they were about and what their policies were.
And I think Melissa Lowe, who I think can be described as a teal, she's reported to have said she spent $181,000 on her 2022 campaign and thinks without the caps she would have received between $50,000 and $200,000 from, say, the Climate 200 group, which would have helped with her campaign. Is that your understanding?
Certainly that was in the materials before the court and was, I guess, consistent with other donations Climate 200 had given to the federal candidates that had contested elections a few months before Melissa's 2022 stint in the state regime.
So how did you argue that this regime interfered with the implied freedom of political communication?
So we said to the court that when you look at this system, obviously the donation cap creates a real burden, and that's an important feature of the implied freedom, whether or not a person's ability to communicate on political matters is burdened in some way, which certainly these donation caps had that effect. Yet it didn't have the effect on the major parties because of this access to nominated entity money. And the outcome of that in a practical sense was that they could really distort the field of communication by, as I said, spending an unknown amount on their comms and buying up billboards and putting out lots of radio ads, which a new entrant just couldn't afford to do because they may not have had the money to do so. So I guess the practical impact of the laws was that they would enable new entrants to be massively outspent. I guess one of the other legal arguments that we ran was that this was also an example of the major parties privileging themselves in the enactment of legislation which concern elections, and that we felt was a real problem when one had regard to the implied freedom of political communication, its concern with, I guess, equity in some respects.
So in finding that the advantages given to the nominated entities were unconstitutional, the court was forced to then strike down a large part of what the legislation also covered because it felt it couldn't disentangle. If it struck down the nominated entities, it couldn't disentangle that from all the other pieces of the legislation. So what else did it strike down?
They felt they couldn't disentangle it, and also they weren't, when they looked at how the legislation passed through Parliament, they just weren't sure that the legislation would have passed without those exceptions. So they didn't want to, obviously the High Court doesn't want to perform the role of Parliament in setting out what the laws should be. They can only strike out what they think is unfair. And so in this case, it was both those factors that the nominated entities were woven through the legislation such that they felt they had to strike through the entirety of that reform that passed in 2018. And that reform included some of the things I mentioned earlier, such as the real-time disclosure.
On donations.
The public funding, both for elections and also for administrative funding and policy funding for parties. Prohibitions on foreign donors.
Also prohibitions on anonymous donations as well.
Correct, yes.
So, Kieran, this does open up a big Pandora's box. It does create a free-for-all, and I know that it addresses a problem which certainly the unanimous view of the High Court was did impact on your clients and did impact on their ability to communicate politically. But this does open us up for a free-for-all, doesn't it?
Yes. So at the moment, there is a big gap, and there's a gap that certainly needs to be filled by new legislation.
So at the moment, Climate 200 will be able to donate unlimited funds to teal candidates, potentially billionaire Gina Rinehart, who supports One Nation. She might be able to direct unlimited funds to, say, One Nation candidates, potentially. Billionaire Clive Palmer could financially support candidates that he likes. But if there's a new legislation, that would prevent that kind of thing happening, but also maybe prevent the established parties from using their nominated entities to financially support without limits their own candidates?
I should say that in the course of the case being heard both at the state and also, you know, council. My clients were very much contending that the provisions we were concerned with in relation to nominated entities could be struck through and the whole thing didn't need to fall, but it turned out the court, upon reflection, felt that wasn't the case and needed to do what it did. In terms of any approach to how this can be fixed, I think it's important to bear in mind that there are a whole bunch of provisions that fell away that are really not controversial. So there's an approach to those which we're, you know, re-legislating the things like real-time disclosure and the prohibitions on certain types of donors can be done quickly and importantly. In respect of the broader question of, well, how do we have a financing system that is fair and reasonable, certainly part of that has been struck through by the court's decision. And so it, in a sense, falls to the government to seek to have the right conversations around what a fair system looks like and if there are going to be nominated entities in it, what money can they give that doesn't privilege the major parties and distort the playing field, and what do independents and new entrants in particular need to be able to properly run a campaign and communicate with the electorate. And so my experience has been that those questions are never one-dimensional. They usually involve considerations of what's appropriate public funding and how should that be deployed, what appropriate donation caps are and what are the levels at which they should be set for various types of political actors. And also there's been raised in the past questions of whether or not there should be expenditure caps. So they're not simple conversations to have, but court's decision means there's a bit of a blank canvas about what we can have that and what the government should do that is fair.
So, of course, this challenge related to Victoria's, 2018 electoral law system. Kira, at the federal level, you act for two former parliamentarians who are challenging federal legislation, which has been passed and is going to come into effect on, I think, the 1st of January 2027. Tell me about that challenge.
Yes, the laws were meant to commence in a couple of months, but there's been some difficulties implementing them, so that they're now set to commence on the 1st of January, as you say. So those laws brought in a whole raft of reforms at the federal level to our elections. In terms, they brought in certain types of donation caps, expenditure caps, similar increases in public funding, and real-time disclosure as well. So they were the four core aspects, I think, of the reforms that were introduced. My clients in that case are Zoe Daniel, the former MP for Goldstein, and Rex Patrick, the former senator for South Australia. Their primary contention to the court is that the structure of various aspects of the donation caps and the expenditure caps, also impermissible burdens on the implied freedom of political communication, because, again, the argument that we are putting forward is that they privilege the major parties and have the risk of creating an unlevel playing field.
And so you'll be using similar arguments to what you used in this case involving Victorian legislation?
Yes.
Kira Peacock, principal lawyer with Ripple Legal, who acts for two independent politicians in their upcoming challenge to federal campaign financing laws, and also acted for two Victorian independent political candidates who successfully overturned Victoria's electoral donation laws. And unless this legislative pothole is filled in, Victoria's state election could see a lot of freewheeling, big-spending campaigns. I asked Dr. Catherine Williams from the Centre for Public Integrity, how has the Victorian government responded to the High Court's decision?
So in the immediate wake of the decision, the government came out very quickly and said that it would legislate urgently in order to fill that vacuum. We, at this point, don't really know what that is going to look like. We do know from reporting that the government is continuing to pursue various pathways to passage for that legislative package, and what people are talking about as certainly going to be features, regardless of which pathway is chosen, transparency returning, public funding returning, donations caps at some level returning. And what we are really concerned about is the speed with which this is now being dealt with. It would probably appear likely that legislation may emerge next week. Now, that's a very, very quick turnaround on legislation that affects fundamental democratic rights. We need to be very careful about how we legislate in this area.
Do you think that there should be a stopgap measure put in place ahead of this coming election, state election, and maybe would you want to see sort of a deeper dive into what is the best system going forward?
That's exactly right, Damien. We, of course, accept that the circumstances in which the state finds itself means that there does need to be an urgent interim response, because Victorians deserve to have, at an absolute minimum, transparency in respect of who is trying to support which candidates and which parties in the lead up to this election. And we need there to also be certainty around public funding, because if there isn't, it will disincentivise and potentially prevent candidates who are not wealthy candidates from participating, and we absolutely don't want to see that happen. So certain minimum elements of the previous Part 12 do need to be returned, and in my view, those minimum elements are the transparency requirements and the public funding requirements. There's an opportunity now for Victoria to put in place a really robust and, importantly, independent process to take place after the election, when there's time to have really this ground-up rethink of what a holistic and optimally designed political finance regime could look like that deals with the problem of undue influence, the real and perceived problem, and also deals with the fairness issues that the previous scheme created.
And briefly, do you think a similar conversation needs to take place at a federal level?
I certainly think that a similar conversation needs to take place at federal level. One of the real shames in relation to the passage of the federal package at the start of 2025 was that there was no meaningful public consultation process. There was no parliamentary inquiry into that legislation. Debate was guillotined in the parliament. In relation, again, we're talking about fundamental democratic rights, the integrity of our electoral system. And there is not in place in the federal legislation a statutory review to take place once this legislation's been through one cycle. So we won't even have transparency, upon which accountability depends, in relation to what these reforms have achieved. And that contrasts strongly with what happened in South Australia, where people may have different opinions in relation to the merits of aspects of those reforms, but there was a robust process in place, and there is a genuinely independent statutory review process in place that the government is required to appoint before 1 January 2027. And it will ensure that any challenges that the legislation has presented, what the consequences of it have been, will be able to be known by the South Australian people. It's really, really important.
So there's an ongoing process to try and make sure that the rules are fit for purpose. And that's what you're saying we need everywhere.
That's exactly right. We need it everywhere. We should have it really as a general matter of practice in respect of the legislative process. Legislation, particularly where it's affecting fundamental democratic rights, should have a statutory review process in place. Even more so when we're dealing with an area of law that sees the lawmakers making decisions that very directly affect their own interests. Even more in these cases, we need to have that robust independent process in place.
Dr. Catherine Williams, Executive Director of the Centre for Public Integrity, thank you for speaking to the Law Report.
Thanks so much, Damien.
That's all we have time for this week. Do follow the Law Report on ABC Listen. That way you'll get the latest podcast as soon as it becomes available. A big thanks to producer Christina Kukolia and to audio producer Riley Mellis. I'm Damien Carrick. Talk soon.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.